Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for May 2012. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird!
It's a plane!
It's Superman! Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with...
These sounds are familiar to anyone who's seen the Superman television program from the 1950s. Many of us are familiar with the story of Superman, a friendly visitor from another planet who, after arriving in our solar system, gains superpowers and the ability to fly. The backstory of the Superman comic books came to the attention of James Gould, an attorney who's a partner and litigator with the firm of Locke Lord LLP in New York City. James found the story so intriguing that he wrote a paper entitled Comics and Copyright and a Super Legal Battle that he recently presented to the New York Intellectual Property Law Association. In it, he described the over 60-year-long copyright legal battle between the teenage creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and DC Comics, who commercialized their creation. I spoke with James from his office in New York City. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Don.
Jim, the story of Superman comic books is now almost 80 years old. Can you take us back to chapter one of the story when it all started from a copyright point of view?
It actually started on a hot summer night in 1934 in the little town of Glenville, Ohio. Two teenagers, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, were high school buddies, loved comics, comic strips, and developed these characters together. Now, they wrote them first as comic strips and tried to sell them because that's where the money was, syndicated comic strips. Comic books as such really were not really around very much. So they created this superhero. And to cut to the chase, they ended up ultimately snipping and cutting those strips, put them into a comic book, which became Action Comics number one, the origin story of Superman, which immediately broke all records of sales, 1.3 million copies, and effectively created the whole category of superheroes.
And at that time, in terms of the ownership of the copyright, I understand that they sold the exclusive rights to Superman to have and hold forever for a fairly paltry sum.
It was. The check, which has actually been sold at auction for a lot of money, was $130, and on the back of it, they signed away their rights. In context, that would be worth about $2,000 today. It doesn't sound like much, but that was about the going rate at the time on a per-page basis.
And then Siegel and Shuster went to work for Detective Comics, the people that published the Action Comics, right?
That is correct, and they entered into an actual employment agreement. So they had a written employment agreement, and the legal point, they also had that assignment on the back of the check. So those are some of the legal parts of it that were fought over for many years to come.
Now, the authors, I understand from your paper, went through hard times during World War II, and Chapter 2 of their story really gets us up to about 1947, when they tried to annul and rescind the assignment.
That's true. They brought suit in state court in Westchester County of New York, which is north of New York City, and they lost at trial. They said there was not sufficient consideration or rescission and annulment. And there was a special referee who said, no, you made a deal, maybe you don't like it, but it's a legal deal, it is effective. What's interesting, because they still were trying to have these people do work for them, they did still settle for $94,000, but in return they affirmed, yes, DC has the full ownership of all these rights.
And now if we move further forward in the story to 1969, we enter Chapter 3, about the time that the copyright in the subject matter was due for renewal. How did things work back in 1969 in terms of copyright terms and renewals?
There were actually two terms, an initial 28-year term and a renewal term of 28 years. Now, the Copyright Act said, well, you have these two pieces, and Siegel and Shuster had the theory that, well, when we did all those assignments, all those agreements, that was the initial term, not the renewal term. So we want that renewal term back. Unfortunately for them, a little before their suit, the Supreme Court had actually looked at this issue and said that the assignment of all rights, if you have that in writing clear, it applies to the renewal term, even if it hasn't started yet. So they just flat out lost.
So by the early 1970s, Mr. Siegel and Mr. Schuster, our heroes, were in trouble. And now it becomes interesting. Who could come to the rescue of the authors? Would it be Superman? Would it be Batman? Who?
Well, it's somewhat related to Batman. The actual name was Neil Adams. By this time, the Siegel and Schuster were being blackballed by the industry and having a hard time finding work at all. They brought a lawyer to try to help them, didn't get anywhere, they'd lost. Neil Adams is a well-known artist to comic fans, has been involved with Batman in the drawing of it and turning it to the dark side, which you see in all the modern movies. So Neil is really a well-known artist in his own right, still practicing in New York, and he got involved and said, this isn't right. He just jumped in there all on his own for no pay and took it on as essentially attorney in fact. And really, as is spelled out in the article, did a marvelous job of playing publicity and other things to ultimately get them a decent settlement of pensions of $25,000, medical benefits, and another big thing for the artist, all artists, to get credit for being the creators. You can't underplay that. Yes, money is important, but that creative attribution is a big deal.
So by 1990, the story was effectively over, right?
Well, by the 75-76 settlement, you would think so. But then what happened, Congress came in 1976, right after the settlement, and they changed the terms of about this, the rights for this renewal. And what they actually did is said, even if you've given an assignment of the copyright to somebody, that you could come back, give notice, and take back the renewal rights. Think of it like a reversionary interest. You could do that so long as it was not a work for hire. And that's where a lot of the legal battles came out.
Now, what is or was the definition of work for hire?
Well, originally it would be an employer-employee relationship. I mean, someone who works for Disney coloring in the cells for a cartoon, he's an employee. You don't need an assignment of the copyright to Disney. Disney owns the work. It's a work for hire by an employee. What was happening, though, is the courts were expanding that out to say the work for hire can be in other kinds of situations, even if you're maybe technically a freelancer, depending on the degree of control, whether it's commissioned work. And the act, which said you can get back the rights, also said, well, but not if it's a work for hire, and said that can apply in certain factual settings, even if it's not an employer-employee relationship. So that was the big deal of a new lawsuit that was brought in 2008. The question is, the boys, when they were teenagers, had created what became Superman number one. Those comic strips were cut and pasted and put into Action Comics number one. They owned the renewal copyright to those, but not the stuff that was created later. Things like Kryptonite, like Superdog, like Lex Luthor, a lot of the other aspects of Superman that would belong to DC Comics. So that was the legal battle that was fought out in the in California federal court.
Now we move to the present day and what I'll call Chapter 6. What's still pending then from the 2008 lawsuit?
Well, the 2008 decision actually said that Siegel's heirs won. Mr. Siegel and Mr. Schuster, unfortunately, never lived to see that victory. And Siegel's wife also died before then, but the daughter is still pursuing it. So they won the decision. They said, yes, you have the rights to what's in Action Comics number one, not the later stuff. The district court stayed the trial of damages for an appeal. It's up to the Ninth Circuit, it's been briefed, it's been oral argued, and we're waiting on the decision. So that's what we're waiting on.
So if the estate wins with respect to damages, what measure, what sort of damages would they get?
Well, it could be very substantial because, remember, you have derivative rights to copyrights. So the copyright on Superman can extend to the Superman movie that is using the copyrighted aspects. It could also be derivative works of T-shirts, of other things that they may decide to sell. So you're ending up, if it comes back down, and I'll make a rash prediction, I think they'll win in the Ninth Circuit. I think the decision is correct. you'll have to split out between what was in Action Comics number one, things like Superman, Lois Lane, Clark Kent, you know, the Krypton thing, versus the later things that came in the coming years. That will be a battle royal, I'm sure, in court with battling experts, and ultimately a judge or a jury will have to decide the allocation.
So what would you say are the lessons for today's comic strip and video game artists?
Well, a few things. Although it's becoming less important under the new act because you don't have these renewal rights, it's just simply a single term for new copyrights. The artist should always be aware of language and something they sign that has work for hire language. Even if they don't have that, they should be aware of using the facilities of a company if they're a freelancer. The use of company facilities and supplies can be a factor under the Supreme Court for saying it is a work for hire, even if you don't sign that. You should also distinguish between the ownership of the physical art, the original art. Who owns that is separate and apart from the copyright to that. And a lot of artists don't realize. You should always remember that original physical art can be very valuable, as it is today with cartoon art. Some of those original things are quite valuable. Also, they should be not shy of insisting on attribution. Under the recent copyright changes, they're protected by statute. You really, unless you expressly waive the rights, you have a right to be attributed as the author. And that, of course, is very important for an artist's career. Finally, if at all possible, they should try to license it rather than assign it. That's not easy to do, not easy to negotiate, but it's something to at least think about trying for as their reputation gets up, so they don't assign away all the rights too cheaply, as Siegel and Schuster did, and actually have a share of ongoing royalties for the future.
It's a it's amazing to me how long the story has taken to be told and how many rounds there have been with the estate or the family coming back.
And that's why I kind of got into this. It began, if I told you the backstory, my nephew, John Barrett, who I give attribution in the final article, he's coming to visit New York, and he's a super comic fan, and he arranged to go around a couple of these places, mm-hmm. and Neil Adams is one. So we got in there, and you know, he is being very nice. He is very busy, because he's still a full-time artist. He said, yeah, as a fan, and my nephew John is gushing over him. And I said, you know, Neil, I just have to ask you, I understand that you were involved somehow with this copyright battle of Superman. What's that all about? About an hour and a half later, he was still holding forth, and his son and his assistants, the daughter, all there trying to say, you got to get back to work. And he's going, no, he wants to talk. So I grabbed the pad and started scribbling furiously, which is how I can get these quotes. I was scribbling around it as he was saying all these things. Just, my God, what a story. So it's partly I was just got fascinated by copyright and this whole human story of the battle for 60, 70 years, but also Neil Adams. I said, well, this is a pretty great guy. Look what he did for no money. He jumped in there and did this just to help these guys out and said, you know, that's a story should be told. There's been a number of stories written about Superman, and there's a lot to talk about the evolution of the story itself. The $130 check is well known in the field. No one I could see of has really told this full story and the fleshing out of Neil and the dynamic of it and brought it together with the law. So that I just was intrigued in writing this. It's a combination of law and evolution of statute and case law, but there's this human story behind it. It's kind of fun. And so to weave those two together, it's just been a lot of fun. It's a different kind of article.
Thanks very much for these insights, Jim.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about this, Don. It's been a pleasure.
My guest for this podcast has been James Gould, a partner with the firm of Locklord LLP in New York City. Stay tuned to Jurisdiction for the continuing saga as the estate of Mr. Siegel and Mr. Schuster
fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
For further information on James Gould, his firm Locklord LLP, and for a copy of James' paper on comics and copyright and a super legal battle, and for information on our other Jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.